Live openings, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
Mutual Management is now accepting students in off-campus affordable housing on the West Bank and at the Blue Goose Co-op. Unfamiliar with cooperative living? Mutual Management Company can answer all your questions. Find community or build it by calling Mutual Management at 612-333-9164. 612-333-9164.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and on the web at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.
Happy Pride, and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. I'm your host, Michael Whetstone, and this afternoon, we are proudly presenting Mini Culture. Mini Culture is KFAI's award-winning audio storytelling program. Today, we are going to begin with four brand new, hot-off-the-press stories, piping hot and right out of the oven, and all of them quite topical to the world around us right now. At the top of the show, at the very top of the show, we're going to the Twin Cities Pride Festival to get the lowdown on the parade's history and the folks who shaped it. After that, we're going to hop on the nostalgia train with Armory Rivard as she revisits the Lunch with Casey television program. Then we are going to drastically shift gears and learn about forensic investigators adhering to what has become known as the Minnesota Protocol, a set of guidelines for examining suspicious deaths. Then we're also going to hear an audio portrait of Halima Osman, a Somali immigrant here in Minnesota. Then, after the break, in the second half of the show, we are going to take a step outside and learn about butterflies, backpackers, and bikers. So stick around for that. But first, we remember Ashley Rooks, the namesake of the Twin Cities Pride Parade. Actually, before we do that, I've got some beyond bittersweet news to share. We are saying goodbye to Mini Culture's managing editor, Julie Sensulo, at the end of June. Julie has been at the helm of Mini Culture for the last 3 years. Anything that you've heard from Mini Culture over that time and you've dug, it's due to Julie. Aside from all the work that she does to make Mini Culture happen, she has been helping the storytellers to craft, edit, and nurse those stories through the creative process from start to finish, getting them radio ready and worthy for air and award winning along the way. She's also taken the Mini Culture podcast in new and exciting directions too. Her fingerprints will be deeply missed on these audio stories. I've loved all of Mini Culture's directors, from Todd and Melissa to Ryan, and I knew from the very minute that Julie got the job that she was going to be a great fit and a great choice. She was not a newcomer to the Twin Cities radio and television scene. She'd been working with TPT, Twin Cities Public Television, including their excellent Minnesota Experience program, and she helps produce the chapter of the Moth Story Slam series. But perhaps most likely and certainly most recognizably to this community was her previous time here at KFEI in the news department, and especially as the station manager at the great Low Watt WFNU radio in St. Paul's Frogtown, where she was one of the founding members. She's not said exactly what she will be up to, but I have a hunch that we'll be hearing more episodes of this spooky audio anthology series that she's been working on, Out Cold, before too long. You can find that, you know, where you find podcasts. Out Cold, we played him here last fall, if you were listening. Good stuff. We're excited for this new chapter. And on behalf of the whole Mini Culture Collective, we thank you, Julie, and wish you all the best, and are ultra jazzed to hear what audio projects you're going to be brewing up. Speaking of which, back to the show. Here's Julie.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. In 1993, a transgender woman named Ashley Ann Rooks took over as the director of the Twin Cities Pride Parade, and she changed the parade forever. KFAI's Dixie Treichel shares this story.
Each year, thousands of people line the streets for the Ashley Rooks GLBT Pride Parade. But who was Ashley Rooks? And why is the parade named after her? Ashley Ann Rooks, a transgender woman, loved parades ever since she was a child. Her enthusiasm for pageantry and community inspired her to become involved with parades as an adult. Ashley became the Aquitennial Grand Day Parade Chair for a year and gained experience in organizing a parade on a large scale. Preferring to work with the LGBTQ community, she turned towards the Twin Cities Pride Parade, an event she found politically and spiritually significant. And in 1990, she started working with Twin Cities Pride. Seeing how the parade could be improved, she knew there was more to be done. The turning point for Ashley and the Twin Cities Pride Parade came in 1993, when with her organizing skills and experience, she took full command of the parade. Anne DeGroot. She was a colleague of Ashley Rooks.
I knew Ashley when I was the executive director of Outfront Minnesota, and Ashley was on our board of directors. Ashley was a very kind person, a very community-oriented person. And Ashley brought to our LGBTQ community her skills and her expertise as a parade organizer from the Aquitennial, and she professionalized the Pride Parade.
Archivist Stuart Van Cleve in 2011, talking about Ashley when he was the historian for the Twin Cities Pride Committee.
In 1992, she went to the Twin Cities Pride, saw the parade, and was horrified at how disorganized it was. So then 1993 rolls around, and she sends this letter that's called Stuff About Your Parade, and it basically just completely critiqued everything about the parade. She hated it. It was all wrong. And so she decided that she was the only person who could fix this. And the theme of 1993 was a family of pride. The idea was is that you were going to get the whole family together, all the different groups, and have them all have a voice and be represented.
This is Ashley Rooks in an interview with historian Scott Paulson in October 1993.
When I started working with the Pride Festival, the parade had traditionally been rather a free-for-all. The lineup on that street on Sunday morning, first come, first to march. In the past several years, we've organized ourselves, we've set ourselves all down on paper, we know who one another are. I love this.
People would see Ashley riding her magnificent red tricycle up and down the parade route, making sure everything was in order. They loved her no-nonsense approach and community-oriented spirit. Brad Tyson was a host with Green and Yellow TV. Here he is broadcasting live at the 1993 Twin Cities Pride Parade.
Here's Ashley Rooks on the bike. She put on today's parade. She's the number one head cheese. There's Ashley. Really good. Thanks for asking.
Ashley was a maverick at producing parades that broke barriers. Her parades became more inclusive with trans visibility, a variety of ages and cultures, and brought LGBTQ plus people and allies together in solidarity and celebration. Here's Ashley again in October 1993.
District 202, for instance, this was a big deal, and that's the first time youth had ever been in that parade. For the first time, there were two groups of Southeast Asians and East Asian and Polynesian individuals were bringing people of color, a multicultural attitude into our home. I think that's positive stuff.
I like the way that Ashley Rooks has the parade put together this year. People of similar interests their units kind of follow each other.
During her time as parade director, Ashley expanded 30 units in 1992 into 270 units in 2000, making the Twin Cities Pride Parade the largest of any kind in Minnesota and the surrounding states. In June 2000, just a week before the Twin Cities Pride Parade, Ashley passed away unexpectedly at the age of 52. Here's Anne DeGroot again.
It was shocking to us when she died. I remember being at the Outfront office at the time, and we got a phone call. We were stunned. Ashley really left an impact.
The 2000 Twin Cities Pride Committee decided to name the parade in Ashley's honor, the Ashley Rooks GLBT Pride Parade, as it is still known today in 2025. Ashley Rooks is one of the most significant figures in Twin Cities Pride history.
She had this penchant for wearing like militaristic clothing, and so she was just this total presence. She would command and they would follow. Her era was probably the best in terms of parades.
This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI.
This story was written and produced by Dixie Treichel. Archival audio in this program is courtesy of the Treader Collection in GLBT Studies at the Minnesota Historical Society and KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE. If you grew up in the Twin Cities in the 1950s, you may remember a popular broadcast on Channel 11 called Lunch with Casey. The show was written and produced explicitly for children to watch during lunchtime. KFAI's Armée Rivard reflects on a show that defined her childhood.
Oh my gosh, wow, it's Lunch with Casey. I haven't thought of that show in years.
Well, hi, gang, your old buddy Casey Jones. Once again, and according to my trusty old Redwood watch, we're right on time and all set for a good day. Nice to have you here with us. Are you hungry? Well, so am I. Let's get over and see what we have for lunch today. Let's go.
The Lunch with Casey show opened with a clip of a train yard with an old steam engine chugging along with the host of the show, Casey Jones, waving out the window. My siblings and I would hear this theme song and come running to have our lunch in front of the television set with Casey Jones and his sidekick, Roundhouse Rodney. The show debuted in May 1954 and aired for close to 20 years. High noon on WTCN-TV, Channel 11. The show's appeal ranged from preschoolers to grade schoolers. My friend Ann Webner remembers the show fondly.
I remember coming home from kindergarten and my mom would set me up in front of Casey Jones with my Campbell's vegetable soup and peanut butter sandwich, and that was our little daily ritual, my lunch in front of Casey Jones.
Casey Jones was played by actor Roger Awesome. Here is Roger in character of Casey Jones describing one of the crazy personalities they featured on the program.
One of the characters we had on the program was Oswald. His real name was Oswald McGum. And Oswald was a character created which had the body of a man upside down, and it would come over the nose. And then this part of the face from here on, painted some eyes here, and then the mouth was a regular mouth. And then we had to flip the camera upside down, and then it would look like a puppet, only a real live one. For some reason, little children were frightened by Oswald.
Oswald here, Oswald McGum. And say, do you hear about the elephant that swallowed a spoon? Well, he hasn't stirred since.
I loved Oswald.
That's my sister Elaine Rivard.
It took me a really long time to figure out that Oswald was Roundhouse's chin. I mean, who would have guessed?
The clever choice of material that inspired the antics of Casey and Roundhouse can still tickle my funny bone, too. In the early years of the program, Roger Awesome and Lynn Dwyer, who played Roundhouse Rodney, wrote and produced the shows with the help of their director, Al DeRuscia. The show aired live, and the personal approach of their characters addressing their young audience while eating lunch proved to be engaging for all the kids who got to join him with their lunch in front of the TV. The show aired in the Twin Cities metro area, and on a good day, the viewers in Duluth could catch the show with a little adjustment of the rabbit ears. Lunch with Casey ran some of the most popular cartoons of the day during the breaks of the show, Looney Tunes, Hanna-Barbera, and Gumby.
One of the most fun songs that we did was I put on a pair of long red underwear, put on a big mustache, and we did this song. Do you remember Walking in My Winter Underwear?
Sleigh bells ring and I'm listening, but I'm turning and twisting, 'cause I'm itching up here and I'm scratching down there, walking in my winter underwear.
I have no idea where they found all these funny songs that they lip-synced to in their skits.
Here's the show's director, Al DeRuscia, demystifying one of my favorite skits.
The idea, well, let's turn the set upside down, but let's hang the set from the ceiling so that when the picture is upside down, the set is upright.
That's pretty cool. How'd they do that, you know? They turned a whole room upside down. Did you try to figure out how it was done? No, I literally believe that they had turned the room upside down.
The most popular segment of the program was the Daily Birthday Song, sung by Casey Jones.
They did the Happy Birthday Song. I thought that was pretty cool, the way that they, you know, wished everybody a happy birthday, and then you got to have your name on the air. It was happy, happy birthday to every girl and boy.
Hope this very special day brings you lots of joy. Hope this birthday present you get from mom and dad will make this very special day the best you've ever had.
And maybe that's a good place to close our program for today. Well, I'm your old buddy, Casey Jones. And better check my trusty old Redwood watch. Hey, we're all out of time, but I hope I'll see you around in many different places around our beautiful state. So this is your old buddy, Casey Jones, saying so long, gang.
This story was written and produced by Armay Rivard. Archival audio of the Lunch with Casey show is courtesy of CARE TV, Channel 11. You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE. Culture on KFAI. Have you ever heard of the Minnesota Protocol? It's a set of international guidelines used by the United Nations when a government is suspected of being involved. You may have never heard of the protocol, but forensic experts around the world have carried copies in their back pockets for years. KFAI's Michelle Brooke tells this story.
Forensic investigators are looking for unmarked graves in South Africa. They're investigating murders from the apartheid era of 1948 to 1994, when racial segregation was law.
Police have rounded up more than 900 black leaders and suspected leaders and opened fire on angry stone-throwing crowds. That appears to have restored
order. Over 600 people have died already, and hundreds more have disappeared. People are dying.
That was Dumisani Khumalo of the U.S. Committee on Africa.
The South African government created the Missing Persons Task Team in 2005 to locate secret burial sites, identify remains, and return bodies to families. They use the international gold standard for death investigations. This gold standard is called the Minnesota Protocol.
It's such an interesting piece of Minnesota history that not very many people know about.
This is Jennifer Prestholt from the Advocates for Human Rights in Minneapolis.
I go around the world and people are like, oh, Minnesota, do you know the Minnesota Protocol?
The Minnesota Protocol is used for investigating suspicious deaths. It comes into play when a government is suspected of unlawful killing, or someone dies in prison, or when people disappear and the state never investigates. The protocol has been adopted by the United Nations.
Excellency.
This is a 2024 meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Speaking now is the representative from Brazil.
Implementation of the Minnesota Protocol. Additionally, we express our appreciation for your support in promoting the Portuguese language version of the protocol. Thank you.
It all started in 1983 when a group of Minnesota lawyers formed a committee to volunteer on international human rights issues. Barbara Fry was one of them.
We were just committed that we were going to do this.
At that time, the human rights community was alarmed by the assassination of opposition leader Benigno Aquino in the Philippines.
Newsweek on air. The murder of Aquino, despite a small army of soldiers supposedly guarding him at the airport in Manila, left the opposition shaken and leaderless, but it also cast a cloud of suspicion over the government of President Ferdinand Marcos, and it raised some old questions about...
We all knew that when then-President Ferdinand Marcos said that there would be a thorough investigation, when it was pretty obvious that the government had authorized the assassination, that there was really no standard against which to judge what was going to be a good investigation.
That meant governments could get away with murder and never expect to face accountability from anyone.
If someone committed mass murder, the most we could hope for is that they would be exiled some villa in France or Saudi Arabia. Those were always seemed to be where people went, you know. And the thought of holding high-level violators accountable was just impossible.
But the United Nations wanted to somehow address political killings. And the growing use of forensic science made it possible to investigate crimes long after death. Barb's mentor, the late University of Minnesota professor David Weisbrod, thought the volunteer lawyers could take this on. They could bring people together to create international standards for a good death investigation. Barb tried her best to raise money for airfare so they could fly in global experts.
I sort of laugh when I look back at it. I probably had a stack of request letters, you know, an inch thick. Finally, David, through his contacts at the UN, got the Danish government to donate $10,000.
They booked a West Metro Conference Center in 1987 and brought in people from the UN and experts like Dr. Clyde Snow, whose forensic testimony in Argentina helped convict generals of human rights violations.
They're a colorful lot. These guys, when they get talking shop, you know, they're talking about like what it's like to investigate plane crashes and never travel with a pen in your pocket because if you're crashed, the impact of the pen will kill you. And so it made it super fun to work on this case because the personalities involved, like, they were bigger than life.
First, they drafted a set of principles. Investigations must be prompt, thorough, independent, impartial, and transparent. This was exactly what the UN was looking for. Next, with Hennepin County's autopsy protocol as a starting point, they created a manual with procedures like how to collect evidence and analyze skeletal remains. It's been used in countries including Rwanda, Bosnia, Guatemala, and more.
Every country has a law against murder. The question is, what happens when someone is murdered? How do you investigate? I think of it always as a measuring stick to judge whether their investigation is enough.
That pro bono lawyers committee went on to become the Advocates for Human Rights, which has worked on all kinds of cases. They worked with Peru's Truth and Reconciliation Commission to uncover the truth about violence during the 80s and 90s, when subversive groups massacred families and young men suspected of being terrorists disappeared. The commission exhumed mass grave sites in 2002.
In Peru, I met with some of the mothers of the disappeared.
This is Jennifer Prestholt.
They just kept saying to us, we just want to know what happened to our sons. You know, we just want to know where they are. And so the fact that they were able to use the Minnesota Protocol to do an effective investigation and exhumation and return those bodies is a really, really important thing.
In the beginning, the name Minnesota Protocol was just a nickname. But the UN made it official when they revised the standards in 2016, partly because the name stuck and partly to recognize the groundbreaking work of the original drafters. This time, the meeting took place at the UN in Geneva.
It is like a palace. It's giant marble, you know, very grand. But because we were working on the weekend, there was nobody there. You know, so I've been in these buildings a lot, but it was kind of weird to be there, you know, behind the doors.
Behind the doors, Minnesota still had an outsized seat at the table, including Minnesotans who'd worked on the protocol the first time around. They added procedures for DNA analysis, making it possible to identify very old and small samples of human tissue. New guiding principles included the rights of victims' families and the rights of society as a whole.
The right for society to know the truth about what happened in order to prevent that from happening again.
Of course, countries don't always defer to international institutions, including the United States. Here's Barb Fry.
I believe that eras like this one, where we're having huge challenges in getting states to hold other states accountable for terrible crimes, that the most important thing to do is to document and preserve evidence, preserve stories. It may not feel like you can change things today, but it really will help either in accountability terms or at least in memory terms in the future so that people can learn from the violations that are taking place at any given moment.
Barb Fry used to feel extremely frustrated sitting at United Nations meetings, watching the wheels of justice move so slowly. But now, she's watched the Minnesota Protocol grow from an idea to a global field manual. She's seen the impact of truth commissions and trials 40 years after the crimes. She's seen what happens when people don't give up.
Victims and families of victims pretty much never forget, and they never stop advocating for accountability.
This is Michelle Brook for KFAI.
On KFAI. We're all taught to listen to our elders, especially to our grandmothers, our aunties, and generally the wise women in our communities and neighborhoods. Today, audio producer Sundas Hasanmuli shares the story of the most influential and wise woman that she knows, her own mother, Halima Osman.
The grandma hypothesis is an evolutionary theory that older women play an essential role in the community's reproductive health. And some would go as far as to say that helps explain why human women, in particular, live long past their reproductive years. The grandma hypothesis was first proposed by American evolutionary biologist George Christopher Williams in his landmark 1957 paper, Pleiotropy, Natural Selection, and the Evolution of Senescence. In other words, Williams was looking at biological aging. He asserted that at some point in our human evolution, it became advantageous for older women and grandmothers to stop reproducing and instead redirect their energy towards raising and supporting the next generation. He claimed that this conscious refocus not only ensured the survival of the woman's genes through her kin, but also increased her longevity. Williams's hypothesis instrumentally changed prevailing notions of aging, adaptation, and natural selection. And he was met with fierce criticism when he first published his hypothesis, and he's still met with the same criticism to this day. So, what's the criticism? People look towards lions, baboons, and other mammals and point to the fact that Despite grandmotherly care, it doesn't necessarily ensure the survival of the grandchildren. However, I would say the grandmother hypothesis is still a compelling explanation as to why we, humans, and dolphins are the only species of mammals that have menopause in the animal kingdom. And I think it's good to imagine menopause evolve not as an ending, but as a beginning, a kind of strategy for our survival, a way to ensure your own kin, your neighbor's kin, and the community's children, all of us have the chance to thrive. To a degree, we as a species owe our survival to the knowledge and care of our elder women, whether that elder woman has children or not. This is about passing on important messages, keys, and memories in life. That's where we find Halima Osman, a Somali-American teacher assistant, community educator, and founder of Mother's Tutoring Academy, a nonprofit dedicated to closing the educational gap in the Twin Cities. She is a mother of four daughters, a math enthusiast, a Taurus son, and lived so many lives before the age of 40. This is part of Halima's story, in her own words. Let's take a listen.
My name, Halima Osman. When I'm young, I grew up the place, all the people, they are parents. When you go running and do something, every mother or her father say, stop and do that. That's when we grew up. And in the morning, I remember when I'm young, nobody says, wake up and do this. When I'm young, I wake up and you go to school and the teachers is different than the teachers now where they're doing it. I remember if you are one wrongdoing, they do a lot of punishment for that. We grew up for mother is not there, but we have amazing father that time. He is careful us. He go with us. I remember we go with him for the zoo, and I ask him many things. And one day we go to that museum in Somali, has they call Aqal Somali. And I grow that, and we have everything is for movie, school is they have everything. And we learn about English, Arabic, and Italian language, and school is beautiful, beautiful life. After that, I finish in high school. The college name is La Folle. And I take my math and physics. I like that. And I finish that time, I remember, 10 boys and 2 girls. And the other girl, she say, I don't want a math. After that, the professor say, why you are here? If the girl drop up this glass, and I say, I want. When I finish, immediately war is coming.
The Somali Civil War began in the 1990s and inconclusively ended sometime in the mid-2010s. But the echo of war, trauma, and its memories still bleed in many Somali households in the diaspora. For many of us, the war haunts us like a familiar shadow. Whether conscious or not, a lot of the work we do in our culture is releasing grief. War, survivor's guilt, and responsibility of time may not weigh heavy in Halima's life anymore, but it's still a part of the story.
When war is coming, my life is changed immediately because I never see somebody died or the gunfire or everything. Some nights I'm not sleeping when I hear some bombing or something like that. After that, I'm running. I learn about how to survive because every day I remember this very, very, very problem for this. But I talk myself and I'm that group. For my family, I'm the biggest at that time. And I have small sisters and I have brothers. And I say, okay, you see what you see. Your father's died. We have war. But if you are thinking I'm your crazy, what are you doing in the family? Go straight, don't back. When Somali is war, my sisters, my brother, they didn't have schools. Therefore, I don't like that. But I'm so interested because I start to teach how they write Somali language, how to write ABC, how they write math. And they tell me when they come for UK or they come Denmark, they say, every teacher say, how you learn this? And they say, my sister, they are teaching for the wartime. And when I come to United States, I'm teaching too. I like to teach and help the people. If you look at this, you remember where you come from. But what I say, forget about like war, like something bad. But if you have forward made good things, sometimes I see war, everything is. But if I say every time the war, what happened, you forget your future. Dagaal qof baa ku dhinto inuu kuma dhasho waa maamaha Soomaalida ka mid ah. Marka waxaa wax kasta ka fiican intii la isdagaali lahaa in nabadda laga hadlo, in laga hadlo sidii loo wada noolaan lahaa, in laga hadlo meeshan waxa ka dhacay, in la xiliyo oo loo helo wax la sameeyo. Qof kasta waxaan ku waanin lahaa inaad nabadda ka fikirtid.
Thank you for listening. I'm honored to share the voice of Halima Usman, an incredible person living here in Minnesota, a pillar in our community, and one of the wisest women I know, my mother. In celebrating her story, we also honor a powerful idea that the wisdom and support we receive from the older women of our community is one of the most original ways we as humans receive and give care. Whether it's a personal gift, strength, or even duty, I'm grateful for all the women who brought me here today through their love and altruism. And I'm grateful to share this with you too. For KFAI, this is Sundus Hassanali.
You are listening to a radio station like no other. Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, supported by generous listener members just like you and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Today's episode of Mini Culture Presents is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the good people of Minnesota. If you are enjoying today's stories, I strongly recommend that you subscribe to the Mini Culture podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. It is chock full of great arts, history, and culture stories about our great state. You can find it on SoundCloud.com and KFEI.org under the Mini Culture tab. You can also re-listen to, find, and share each of these stories that you've heard here today individually on Miniculture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. We will continue presenting Miniculture stories right here on Miniculture Presents in just a moment. Stick around.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Lost Bayou Ramblers Wednesday, June 25th. Lost Bayou Ramblers are a two-time Grammy-winning progressive Louisiana French band. Lost Bayou Ramblers musically inhabit the gray area between Cajun and Creole, mixing modern sounds and rhythms with traditional lyrics and melodies. World Cafe calls Lost Bayou Ramblers a revved-up version of Cajun music shot through with punk energy and psychedelic fuzz. Opening the show is Ethno USA on the Road. More information on Lost Bayou Ramblers with Ethno USA on the Road is available at thecedar.org.
Everything started to fall into place, and I kind of felt like I was breathing for the first time in 27 years.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Mike McLaughlin, United States Air Force. I served from 2002 to 2005. It was the best decision in my adult life to get the PTSD treatment. I'd been treated for mental health my whole life. I had a lot of trauma growing up. I had a lot of trauma in the military, many different therapies, many different counseling sessions. You start spinning out of control, and they call it catch it, check it, and change it. Cognitive behavioral therapy. It's gotten to that point where I'm catching that I'm spinning, I'm checking it, and now I'm changing it. It doesn't get easier, it gets different. My anger is no longer out of control. I'm a better dad. I'm a better husband. I'm now remarried, and I'm a better person.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
This is Miniculture on KFAI. We use roads to get from one place to another, and we often forget that roads themselves are places where a lot goes on. In today's story, KFAI producer Matthew Schneeman learned how the sides of our highways can be used for more than just changing a tire.
What do you see when cruising down I-35? I think of cows, fences, telephone poles, and grass. But turns out, it's not just grass. It's
big blue stem, little blue stem, slender wheatgrass, switchgrass, prairie drop seed, purple prairie clover.
That's Tina Markison reading off the list of seeds in just one of MnDOT's native seed mixes.
Common milkweed, butterfly milkweed, golden Alexander, blazing stars.
Wow.
Yeah, there's quite a few species listed in each of those mixes.
MnDOT plants these seeds along the sides of Minnesota's roads for managing water, snow, and erosion, but also because butterflies like them, which is important because the monarch butterfly's population has been steadily declining. In response, in 2017, the Federal Highway Administration decided to create a so-called monarch butterfly highway. The insect's 1,500-mile migration path generally follows Interstate I-35, hence the name the Monarch Highway. From Texas up to Duluth, all the states the highway passes through were asked to conserve butterfly-friendly habitats along the way. MnDOT already used native seed mixes for roadside vegetation, but under the Monarch Highway program, they added them to some rest stops as well. Tina Markison is in charge of Minnesota's section of the Monarch Highway. Her official title is
the Roadside Vegetation Management Unit Supervisor.
Part of the Monarch Highway initiative is to physically support native plants and pollinator-friendly species. But also, there's a public education aspect.
Our Goose Creek rest area up near Harris was being built, and so we were able to add some informational panels into that rest area to just educate our road travelers about Monarch Highway and what that is.
Goose Creek rest area is about 50 miles north of the cities. My parents, Chris and Kathy, were heading up north anyway, okay. So I tagged along. It was a fun detour. It's kind of designed to be a detour.
Rest area.
Oh, there's people here.
There's other monarch lovers.
It's a particularly nice rest area, apparently of some fame. Rita, who worked at the rest stop, told us that when it was being renovated, it caused a bit of a stir on account of the budget. Some dubbed it the $1 million rest area.
Is this it?
This is it.
The $1 million rest area? It was actually over $7 million.
It's world famous. Right?
Yeah.
It's great. It's known for its architecture, but if you were a butterfly, you'd notice the plants.
You could see the plantings were butterfly-oriented.
Mm-hmm. You remember what kinds of, like, milkweed?
Milkweed would be further off over here, I believe.
Out front, there's some echinacea, which has health benefits. Yeah. Butterflies like it, too.
That's what's out here by the flagpole.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're so pretty. I love them.
Also.
Nice. Make a good tea, too.
That's what I was going to go get with my tea bag, because I know my husband has it on there. But
there was a kiosk with a touchscreen display where you could swipe through a variety of natural topics, such as the monarch butterfly migration.
In the spring, monarchs leave their overwintering sites, mating and laying eggs as they migrate north.
All in all, it was a pretty good effort. And in general, the project makes sense. There's all this government land that corresponds with the migration path of an important species. Why not do a little bit more to help the bugs? The land's there. We already need to manage the roadside vegetation. But it felt a little paradoxical to me as well. Using land on the side of an interstate to help plants and creatures diminished by things like massive interstates. Also, is it even the best place for these plants to be planted? I kept picturing butterflies getting smashed against the windshields of passing cars.
Our highways are built environment.
Tina Markison again.
So yeah, there's going to be that where our roads are adjacent to conservation areas. I will tell you there's ongoing research that is looking specifically at the question of whether or not roadsides are good habitat or if there's something called a population sink. And MnDOT is very much aware of that research effort, and we are watching closely to see what those researchers find.
Hopefully it does work. But Tina emphasized that the Monarch Highway is just one piece of the puzzle anyway.
it's an all hands on deck. You know, MnDOT can do what we can do, but we also need areas off our roadside to provide that habitat as well. So we will do what we can do, but we're not the silver bullet. We need everybody helping out to turn the pollinator numbers around.
The all hands on deck call can be personal, like planting pollinator-friendly plants, which is cute anyway, or collective, like supporting legislation to help native plants. It's an intimidating task, restoring the populations of insects and animals that have been diminished, not knowing if your efforts matter. But it kind of made me think of something I learned at the Goose Creek rest area.
In the spring, monarchs leave their overwintering sites, mating and laying eggs as they migrate. By May and June, the children and grandchildren of overwintering monarchs have arrived at the furthest reaches of their...
During spring migration, the butterflies fly north and stop about halfway to mate and lay eggs, meaning not them, but their children and grandchildren will be the ones to finish the migration. Likewise, our generations probably won't be the ones to restore the monarch butterflies and other species to their previous numbers. But the monarch butterflies know that what's important is going in the right direction, even if you personally don't make it, because others will.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/minneculture. Minnesota is known for its 10,000 lakes. And maybe more specifically for its canoe culture through the pristine lakes of the Boundary Waters. Over 50 years ago, a group of eager backpackers were looking for more opportunities to see this enchanted region, not only from the water, but from the land. And thus, a long-distance backpacking trail was born. Podcaster and long-distance hiker Allison Young has this story about the origins of the Border Route Trail.
A storm is brewing, and the wind is getting wild. It's threatening to throw me off balance as I stand as close as I dare to the edge of a cliff 300 feet above Rose Lake. Even in sideways rain, I can see the water highway below me. Far easier than humping a pack on foot, the lakes have been used for centuries by the Anishinaabe and later the French voyagers, who paddled birch bark canoes deep into the wilderness. I'm rewarded with this magnificent view because I walked here. I walked the 65-mile Border Route Trail. It traverses the Boundary Waters in the far northeast corner of Minnesota. Built entirely by volunteers, the Border Route Trail, or BRT, is the first long-distance backcountry trail in the state. And like a lot of big ideas, it got its start in a rather simple way.
Here's how it came to be. So a bunch of us were sitting around at a party.
Bob Jarvis serves on the board of the BRT. In 1971, he and other members of the Minnesota Rovers Outdoors Club were just brainstorming ways to backpack in the Midwest when they stumbled upon an idea.
We were looking at this topo map, and we noticed this trail that looked like an abandoned trail that went from the base of Eagle Mountain up to Brule Lake. So we said, this is kind of a nice area. It'd be nice to restore this trail. So we got permission from the Forest Service and went to work with machetes and chainsaws and Sven saws. And we said, oh, well, this is kind of fun. So let's talk to the Forest Service and see if they have any other ideas. And they did.
When Congress passed the Wilderness Act in 1964, the lakes north of Eagle Mountain along the international border came under federal protection. They were quickly becoming very popular with canoeists. Jarvis tells me that the Forest Service was hoping to take some of the environmental load off of the lakes And they would do this by building a hiking trail along the high ridges of the border. It would serve a dual purpose of getting people more easily to the stunning views like where I was standing. But just how long does it take to build a 65-mile trail through wilderness?
Okay, the short answer is about 10 years, because there was nothing there other than these portages and a few trails that went up from the lake up to some of the sites. So the first thing that we had to do was send out scouting parties. You know, we had to find the campsites, find the portage trails, find road accesses, and then scout all along the whole proposed trail corridor and see what things we wanted to include on the trail and what the ground was like, you know, what the topography was like.
It took many weekends of wandering through the woods with blue ribbons to lay out a corridor, then cutting back brush and creating a path.
It was a little bit scary sometimes because, you know, this was back before you had GPS. What we had was a compass and a topo map. So you had to be really aware of the contours and landmarks and portage trails and streams that could tell you where you were, because otherwise you could get lost, seriously lost. And of course, we didn't go wandering off by ourselves. You know, we were always up there in groups, and the Forest Service people knew that we were there. You know, if we didn't come out, they'd come looking for us eventually. So.
As I dropped down from the cliffs back into the forest and pushed through overgrown thimbleberries up to my chin, it's obvious that building the trail was just the beginning. The BRT needs constant maintenance. Major blowdowns like the extremely powerful windstorm in 1999 called a derecho knocked down around 25 million trees like dominoes and made the trail impassable. It would take 2 years to clear the damage. And our Minnesota winters are rough on the trail.
The winter snow, when you've got shrubs that grow alongside the treadway, you get a heavy snow, those get weighted down and permanently bent into the middle of the trail. And those are actually harder to remove than the trees you can just do with a chainsaw. With these shrubs that get bent over, you have to do each little stem with a nipper or we've got these little chainsaws now that are like chainsaws on a stick.
Chainsaws are only allowed on the small part of the trail outside the boundary waters. All other maintenance on the BRT is done by hand, with cross saws and loppers. Almost 50 years after Jarvis and his friends came out here, the border route became part of the federally protected National Scenic Trail system. It's only a tiny fraction of the North Country Trail, which stretches over 4,000 miles from Vermont into North Dakota. Crossing a flooded pond atop a beaver dam, I hear a loon yodel from a lake out of view. Fluorescent yellow fungus grows on a tree at eye level, and it's so quiet, I can hear my heartbeat. That's when I wonder if maybe where my feet are right at this moment might be the most beautiful part of it all. For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Minnesota is home to some of the best bicycle trails in the nation. From cityscapes to forests and prairie, and all along Lake Superior, there are over 4,000 miles of paved trails. One summer day, avid bicyclist and producer Allison Young left work in downtown St. Paul and hopped on an urban trail that would link up with a whole string of trails to eventually ride all the way to Canada. In today's story, Allison tells us about this ride and shares some of what she's learned about these trails.
I ride into Pine City and take a break at the park, leaning my bike against a small fence. The fence protects a 45-foot statue made of California redwood and a marvel of chainsaw art, depicting a voyager complete with sash and paddle. It's one of the roadside attractions I take in as I ride north on U.S. Bicycle Route 41. The 300-mile-plus bike route was dedicated in 2016 and connects existing regional trails with roadway shoulders to take an ambitious rider from the capital, St. Paul, to Canada. Now, that may sound like a lot, but if you've ridden the Grand Rounds or the Gitche-Gamie, you've already touched your tires on Route 41. As I push north from the cities through prairie and one charming town after another, I wonder why this route is here and how it got built. The best way to find out is to ask. So I call up someone on the front lines of planning and supervising trails in the state, Dorian Grilley.
My message has always been that biking and walking is important in every community in Minnesota. It's good for public health, it's good for kids, and it's good for the environment. But mostly, it's a great asset for a community because people want to live in places where it's safe for their kids to bike and walk.
Dorian recently retired as executive director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. He also worked with the Parks and Trails Council and Department of Natural Resources, and he's a year-round bicyclist. He tells me that the idea for long-distance bike routes throughout the United States was hatched over 50 years ago.
It started with a group called Bike Centennial. It was 1976. Sorry. So people who ride from community to community or state to state on multi-day adventures, they wanted, you know, some recommendations and safe routes that cities and counties and states could use as priority for adding things like shoulders or off-road bicycle trails.
The Minnesota legislature put specific criteria about bike routes into state statute, including authorizing the Department of Transportation, MnDOT, to plan the trail. But the one I'm riding, Route 41, is actually the second route in Minnesota. The first route was established 5 years earlier and has a higher number, Route 43. I know that's a bit confusing, but the numbers have nothing to do with when the route was established. Rather, the numbers ascend as they go west. Route 43 follows the Mississippi River from Itasca State Park to the Iowa border. And just like Route 41, much of it is on roads. But some of it is on regional off-road trails, like the Paul Bunyan, which extends all the way from Bemidji to Crow Wing State Park. And as you can imagine, the Mississippi River Trail attracts quite a crowd.
The Mississippi River is internationally famous. Even I was surprised to learn the bicyclists are helping the hotels and motels in towns like Wabasha and Lake City. They're actually making the difference of a good year or a bad year.
Continuing my ride on Route 41 past Hinckley, I meet the Munger Trail. It's an old railroad bed, paved all the way to Duluth, with hilltop views of Lake Superior and a ride right through funky Canal Park. Just last year, the route was named after the late Minnesota Congressman Jim Oberstar, who promoted converting our transportation infrastructure from a hydrocarbon-based system to a carbohydrate-based system. He was a big supporter of bike trails and sponsored legislation that included the successful Safe Routes to Schools program. To do all that takes a lot of advocacy.
Resolutions from cities and counties, chambers of commerce kind of thing, prominent business leaders, mayors, you know, certainly a lot of community outreach.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is. That's why I'm retired.
On my final day riding north, I meet the steepest grade yet up Mount Josephine, and I have to downshift to granny gear. The views are astounding out to Isle Royal and the Susies before I fly down the other side to Grand Portage State Park and the border at the Pigeon River. Dorian Grilley may be retired, but he tells me he still bikes every day. I'll need that kind of time myself if I'm going to ride all the trails and routes in Minnesota. And since the Mississippi River Trail Route 43 comes right through St. Paul, a bicyclist could combine both trails and ride the entire length of Minnesota, the long way. Now that's an idea. For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
Excellent programming. Midday programming up on KFAI. Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, so I'm about to take over for, in the stead of the great Chris Berry and his wonderful show, Upside Down. This is Luke Andrews. I normally do Temple Sphere on Saturday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Anyway, I've been a longtime admirer of Chris and his absolutely fantastic show. Nothing typifies KFAI better than the kind of sincerity he brings every single Monday, 2 to 4 p.m.